Lecture 30. Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground.
We are in our course in the very middle of the realist movement. And for those of you who are kind of trying to keep chronological track of where we are, I've been resisting actually putting dates on these movements because it's very difficult to do with any kind of precision. But in a general kind of way, as we said, the Age of the Enlightenment, we can date somewhere like 1600 to 1770, and then the Romantic period from something like 1770 to maybe into the 1840s. By the time we get to the 1850s, we are decidedly into the age of realism, and that's where we find ourselves now. Today we're going to be talking about Dostoevsky, who, as we mentioned in the last lecture, is a realist, but a realist with a difference. His differences as a realist from someone like Flaubert, for example, are part ideological and part biographical and part aesthetic, and the three of them are related to each other. He published his first novel in 1846. It was a novel called Poor Folk, and it was a straightforward realist novel. In Russia, that was called the Natural School, which had been founded by Nikolai Gogol. It was an epistolary novel, which had been a very popular form in the 18th century. An epistolary novel is a novel made up entirely of letters written by characters back and forth to each other. Samuel Richardson's Pamela had been an epistolary novel. We've had occasion to mention that novel several times in this course. And then through the 18th century, there were a lot of epistolary novels. Even after its zenith had passed, novels remained very important as elements in letters or in novels, as we've seen in, for example, the novels of Jane Austen or in Eugene Onegin, how important letters are there, or in Madame Bovary even. The original Poor Folks, his first novel, Dostoevsky's first novel, describes the terrible sufferings of the poor in St. Petersburg in the 1840s. But after that novel was well received too. It was both critically and popularly. It was a successful novel. But after a second novel, he ran into trouble. He became member of a discussion group that discussed, among other things, socialism, which the government deemed to be a seditious group, and he was arrested in 1849, and he was sentenced to death. He was actually taken to the gallows and then remanded at the last possible second, first to 4 years of hard labor in Siberia, and then 6 years as a common soldier in the Russian army stationed on the Chinese border. And so he didn't get back to St. Petersburg till 10 years later, till 1859. And when he came back, his ideas had undergone a really radical transformation. In Siberia, he had reread the Gospels, and he came back to St. Petersburg with an idea that Russian Christianity could save the world from materialism and conformity to Western ideas like Jeremy Bentham's utilitarianism or Adam Smith's enlightened self-interest. He also believed that human beings were fallen, but still free to choose between evil and Christ. And in his later novels, there's almost an obsessive interest in free will and the need to hold on to it at all costs. Even if you have to choose something that means personal suffering and pain, you will do it simply to assert that you still have a free will. Socialism now, after his return, looked like a pernicious doctrine. It looked atheistical. It looked like a denial of freedom. And that, in part, the denial of freedom part, is part of what the novel that we're going to be looking at in this lecture, called Notes from Underground, is really all about. He also had abandoned some of the principles of European realism. As far as he was concerned, European realism spent too much time on and too much attention to surface detail. He wanted to study human character, and he thought that human character was best revealed in moments of intense crisis. So he worked a lot with sensational newspaper stories, the same kind of stories that Henrik Ibsen would use as the material for his plays. He called this a kind of higher realism than mere descriptions of ordinary people living ordinary lives. Critics have sometimes called it sensational realism, and either title will work. It is realism, but it's realism with a difference. If, for example, a child kills his brothers and sisters and then hangs himself, leaving a note that says, "Because we was too many," some realists would pass this up, would avoid it because it's too extraordinary. Dostoevsky was gripped by this kind of story. Why did it happen? What went through the head of that little boy at the moment that he did this? I didn't, by the way, choose that example entirely at random. That is, if you recognize it, as the plot of, part of the plot of Thomas Hardy's Jude the Obscure. Nothing impossible happens in a Dostoevsky novel, but it all happens in a kind of heightened atmosphere, so that reading him is different from reading other realists. This lecture deals with a novel called Notes from Underground, which was written in 1864, and it really served Dostoevsky as a kind of preparation for the great novels to follow, the novels that we're all more familiar with, like Crime and Punishment, The Idiot, The Possessed, or The Brothers Karamazov. Those works are dealt with in other teaching company courses, and so once you've gotten through Notes from Underground, you can perhaps look those up and work your way through those novels as well. Notes from Underground was largely misunderstood in its own day. It didn't sell well, people didn't understand it, people didn't like it, but over the 150 years or so since its publication date, it has grown slowly in stature year by year. It's now considered to be sort of a prophetic book of much modern European fiction in its portrayal of an anti-hero. An anti-hero is one whose personal characteristics are almost the reverse of what we think of as a conventional hero, and who usually stands in an adversarial relation to the most of the values of his culture. It's also perhaps prophetic in its assertion of the human need to keep asserting freedom and humanity, even at the cost of personal suffering. And this is going to be one of the themes of this book, and as a consequence of which, this book also serves as a really great introduction to the novels that follow. It's a tricky book, it's difficult to understand what's going on, and it's probably one of the reasons why it was not entirely successful when it was first published. People didn't understand how to read it. It's divided into two sections. The first section is called Underground, and that first section is the confession of a man who tells us that he is spiteful and unpleasant, and that he chooses to live like a mouse. The second section contains two connected stories that happened years earlier. The second one about the underground man's relationship with a prostitute named Liza. Dostoevsky gives us a footnote at the very beginning of the first section about the underground man. What he tells us in that footnote is that the underground man has to exist in modern Russian society because of how that society was formed. So what this means is the author from the very outset distances himself from this underground man. The underground man will speak in his own voice. This is a first-person point of view in this novel. But what Dostoevsky wants to make sure from the very outset is that we understand that there's a distance between Dostoevsky and this underground man. We have to be aware from the very outset the underground man is a persona who's created by the author to tell his own story. The underground man, as he is described to us and as he describes himself in the novel, was created by the waves of isms that had come into Russia in the last half century. Optimism, utilitarianism, utopianism, liberalism, socialism, all of which, as far as Dostoevsky could tell, had in common the assertion that human nature is essentially good and that science and technology can create a utopian and beautiful world for us if we are willing to pursue rational and enlightened self-interest. If we would do these things, then the earthly paradise is almost here, is just around the corner. The second half of the novel, the part that deals with Liza, the prostitute, deals with one particular ism, and that's romantic sentimentalism or romantic humanitarianism. And so we'll take those up one by one. Here, however, is the tricky part of this novel. Dostoevsky uses this novel to criticize these isms and what they do. But as he tells us in that first footnote, he isn't going to do it by giving us a character who rejects them, but by a character who accepts all of these isms, who is formed by them, and then showing us what happens to a character who accepts all of these things. I'm following the reading of a really brilliant Dostoevsky scholar named Joseph Frank, who says that this book belongs in the tradition of first-person satires like Defoe's The Shortest Way with Dissenters. In Defoe's The Shortest Way with Dissenters, the persona in that book argues for the absolute suppression of all dissent from the Church of England, no matter how much cruelty is involved. The book was a satire, but it was misunderstood by everybody, and Daniel Defoe wound up in the stocks for writing it. It's also a little perhaps like Swift's A Modest Proposal, whose persona with a straight face suggests that the way for the English to deal with the Irish problem is to have the Irish parents raise their children to be eaten by the English. Swift didn't wind up in the stocks, but a lot of people both then and since then have misunderstood his work too. Both works require a kind of mental agility. We have to understand that a persona whose values are totally skewed is suggesting something outrageous, and so what we have to do really in some ways is to stand the work on its head, read it upside down and backwards in order to get at its meaning. Defoe was in fact in his book arguing for toleration. Swift was attacking the English for their brutal treatment of the Irish. Swift's Gulliver's Travels may in fact be a similar kind of work in that a sort of dull-witted protagonist endorses views that the author opposes, so again, we have to read a lot of that book upside down and backwards or inside out to get at what Swift is doing. Here, in this book, Frank says this is in that tradition because here we get an unhappy Russian in the 1860s who's trying to live by European codes whose inadequacies Dostoevsky will point out via the flaws and general repulsiveness of the man who holds them. Now, the first couple of paragraphs in this book show what happens to a man in this situation. He's sick. He says he's been sick for a long time. He knows he's sick, and he knows what he should do. He should go to see a doctor. That's what you do when you're sick. But he refuses, as he says, just out of spite, even though he knows he's hurting only himself. And then he says, this is typical of him because he tells us that when he was a civil servant, he used to tyrannize over hapless petitioners who came to see him who needed help, even though he says he isn't a vindictive man. He used to do that anyway. What he tells us from the very outset is his impulses are in conflict with each other. The impulse to see a doctor, which is directed by self-interest, is in conflict with some other impulse, and the impulse to be friendly to the petitioners who came to see him was blocked by egotism or a desire to tyrannize and hurt people. His impulses, at any rate, are all in conflict with each other. And that conflict, or a series of them, is really what this book is about. The contradictions in his nature, he tells us, is what prevents him from behaving in a normal manner, from seeing a doctor, from treating his petitioners with kindness. And he also tells us that it's those conflicts which prevent him from really being anything. He says he's neither a hero nor an insect, but he's a perfectly characterless man, which he says any person living in the 19th century Russia would have to be. According to the underground man, he can't help being what he is because once we accept what he calls the laws of nature, one cannot be a free agent anymore. One simply illustrates those laws. All human choices become impossible. The laws of nature are what he sees as the core of all of these isms. For example, if we all started behaving in a rational fashion, we'd all behave on the basis of enlightened self-interest. And then, according to the terms of this theory, we'd all be good. We'd never be able to behave irrationally again. And if we all behaved in a way of enlightened self-interest, we would in the long run help each other out, and the results would be prosperity and wealth and happiness and a utopia of happiness for everybody. The underground man says that he has problems with that theory because he said, for one, there is really no evidence in any of history to suggest that we are even, as human beings, we're even capable of that kind of self-interest, that kind of virtue, that kind of happiness. And beyond that, he says, there's always one item that's left out of account, and that is free will. Even if exercising our free will means that we have to run against the grain of both individual and corporate happiness, free will is, for the underground man, as it is for Dostoevsky, nearly an absolute value. The symbol for this brave new world in both Dostoevsky's novel and in several novels that had come just ahead of his is the Crystal Palace that was built in London in 1851. Dostoevsky had visited it, and a contemporary novelist, someone named Chernyshevsky, had used the Crystal Palace as a symbol of the future utopia in a novel called What Shall We Do? That novel was published in 1863, and in a way, Dostoevsky is writing his novel in response to that novel. The underground man's point is that if we all behaved according to the laws of nature, according to the laws of enlightened self-interest, we'd all be exactly alike. We would be, as he says, we would all be like piano keys or like organ stops. We would all simply illustrate that 2 plus 2 equals 4, Or, as he says, we would illustrate the logarithms, the tables of logarithms, up to 108,000. What would get eliminated here would be the right to choose, even if it means choosing against one's own happiness. How else, he asked, will we know that we're alive? How else would we know that we're human and not just piano keys? He says he's read in history that Cleopatra, who had almost everything that you could possibly have to make somebody happy, is said to have stuck pins in the breasts of her servant girls just for amusement, just because she was bored. And he said that tells him a lot about human nature and about history and about the need of, for some kind of declaration and assertion of free will. He says, and this is a passage which in which he's talking about this very thing, he says that even if history, and he's talking about the ordinary person here, he said, even if history were to shower him with all sorts of earthly blessings, submerge him in happiness over his head, so that only little bubbles appear on the surface of this happiness, as if on water, give him such economic prosperity that he'll have absolutely nothing left to do except sleep, eat gingerbread, and worry about the continuation of world history, even then, out of pure ingratitude, sheer perversity, he'll commit some repulsive act. He'll even risk losing his gingerbread and will intentionally desire the most wicked rubbish, the most uneconomical absurdity, simply in order to inject his own pernicious, fantastic element into all this positive rationality. He wants to hold on to those most fantastic dreams, his own indecent stupidity, solely for the purpose of assuring himself, as if it were necessary, that men are still men and not piano keys. That is, what he tells us is that we might choose to suffer as a way of asserting our free will. He says he's not defending suffering as a good in itself, only that we might sometimes choose it in order to prove that we're conscious, which for him is the sine qua non of the human personality and character. So the underground man in this first section is not arguing for choices he has made or for the circumstances of his life. He admits freely that if there were some better way of demonstrating freedom than sticking his tongue out at the Crystal Palace, he'd gladly take it. In fact, in section 10 of part 1, Dostoevsky has the underground man wishing for some other way to achieve his aims. But the censors mutilated that chapter, that piece of the novel. And Dostoevsky was irate. He said they let the underground man go ahead and blaspheme for 9 chapters. And then in one chapter, when he even hints at an alternative, they cut the chapter to ribbons. But even through the mutilations, what's left of chapter 10, we can see, at least when we're looking at this book from the vantage point of the last 4 novels, we can see that the direction of salvation for this underground man, it would be teachings and the teachings of and submission to Christ, a solution that Raskolnikov will already find in the next novel. There's a lot more than this going on in the first part of the novel, a lot more ruminations, a lot more really interesting stuff. The underground man may be repulsive, but he's not dumb, and he makes some really, really good cases for a lot of things. I recommend this to your attention. Be prepared to read slowly and take your time with it. And if you don't like The Underground Man, that's quite all right. You're not supposed to. If the first half of the novel satirizes the utopian visions of the 1860s, the second half deals with the romantic visions of the 1840s. The Underground Man tells us something that happened 20 years ago. He went to a party that was a farewell dinner for one of his colleagues at work, and he was humiliated at the party, really deeply humiliated. After the party, he takes out his humiliation on a prostitute, on a very young girl named Lisa, whom he visits after the party. He humiliates her physically, yes, but even more importantly, he humiliates her intellectually. He lectures to her. He gives her a long speech using hundreds of cliches from romantic literature he's read about the disastrous course her life is taking and how she's going to wind up and what do her parents think. And he goes on and on and on and on. He gets, in fact, so carried away by his own rhetoric. She's quiet throughout all. It just listens, takes it in. He gets so carried away by his own rhetoric that at the end of it, he finds himself offering to save her from her life of shame and degradation. When he gets home, And the next morning, he's desperately afraid that she might actually take him up on the offer. He had no intention of making this offer. He simply got carried away by his own rhetoric. But days pass, one day after another, and she doesn't show up, and he begins to relax. And then one night, when he's in the middle of a stupid and embarrassing argument with a servant, she shows up. He and his servant are always fighting, and they're usually fighting about wages and money. And in the middle of one of these really terrible, embarrassing moments, she shows up at his door. Now he is really ashamed. He never intended to help her anyway, so he attacks her for her naivete, for her stupidity. But in the middle of his tirade this time, he breaks down and starts to cry. She understands him in a way that in that kind of intuitive way that so many later Dostoevsky heroines are going to do, and she takes him in her arms, and she winds up comforting him. He's now triply humiliated, and so he takes his revenge on her by taking her sexually first, brutally and physically, and then, as the final insult, giving her money for her services. She leaves, but she leaves the money behind. And when he notices that she has left without the money, he rushes out to try to fling it at her. But she's already disappeared into the snowy night, and after a few more reflections, the novel ends. The satire here is against the romanticism which had come to Russia as early as Pushkin's Eugene Onegin, which we talked about a couple of lectures ago, but which peaked, as far as Dostoevsky could tell, in about the 1840s in Russia. For Dostoevsky, what romanticism did is it stimulated a kind of vague desire to help all humanity, and it allowed one to indulge that fantasy, but always in the abstract, allowing us to feel very noble about ourselves, but never really requiring any action that would actually help anybody. The underground man has spent a lot of time in his mouse hole reading this literature, absorbing so much sublime stuff that he loses his capacity for making direct and simple human actions and for direct and simple human feelings, making him, in one sense, a really, really perverse version of, say, Don Quixote or Emma Bovary, so influenced by his books that it leads him into this, in this sort of distorted picture of humanity. He becomes, in effect, a romantic dreamer who's full of visions of transforming the world, but always, always in the vaguest terms. The dreams make him feel superior to other human beings, who of course are less elevated, less sublime than he is. And when they fail to acknowledge his superiority, then he is humiliated and insulted, which eventually lands him in some difficult situation, as it does with Liza after the party in which he's humiliated, the story he tells us in part two. The talk that he gives to Liza that night is full of quotations from the books he's read. He's using ideas from Balzac and Victor Hugo to impress her and to suggest his superior nature to this young and uneducated and simple young girl. She's so young and so naive that she can't tell that these are cliches. She doesn't recognize them as cliches, and therefore she is really moved by the speeches because she doesn't recognize how conventional they all are. He gets carried away by enough by his own rhetoric to actually try to do something for once, and then he's terrified in the morning when he thinks that she might take him up on it. He's living in a squalid flat. He's wrapped in a mangy dressing gown. He's in constant fights with his servant over wages. And it never once occurs to him how he might actually be able to help her. He's only worried about how he'll look if she ever shows up. When she doesn't show up, he can indulge in fantasies. And these fantasies are really very elaborate as he begins to work them out as days pass and she doesn't show up. He imagines taking her in off the street and then educating her, and then she becomes a really fine and wonderful lady and person, an educated person, but gradually, bit by bit, he can tell that she's falling in love with him, till one day she confesses that she loves him, and then he tells her in the noblest way possible that he wasn't doing it for that reason, that he was doing it only to help her out. And then when she says she can't live without him, she loves him, then he says he wants to make sure that she loves him for himself and not for the help he's been, and just on and on and on and on. He, in fact, uses the word et cetera, every so often in these visions, just suggesting to us, you can fill in the blanks yourself, you know how this goes, because you've read this 100 times in 100 different places before. Then she actually shows up. And when he collapses into tears, then he knows that the roles are really reversed. She has now become the heroine of a romantic novel, and he is the victim who needs saving. And so he chases her out into the snow with the money in hand. And then, I guess this is perhaps, I mean, there are so many unkind cuts that I don't know which is the most unkind cut, but this one seems to me to be near the top. When he stands out there with his money in his hand on the snowy street, realizing she's escaped, he will not be able to find her and catch up with her. He decides that his insulting her will really in the long run be good for her, since suffering always purifies the human soul. The irony here would be too heavy-handed were it not for the fact that we know that the underground man himself has chosen suffering and humiliation in the first part as a way of assuring himself that he really is alive and human and free. And it's even more complicated if we remember that in the novels that are going to follow this one, suffering is a way of purification. The complications here and how we actually read this last moment when he stands there with his money in his hand is so complicated as to make our heads spin. At the end, he returns to his solitude. In the first part, he's longed for an alternative to his way of asserting his freedom. In the second part, he's seen a glimpse of that way, and the glimpse he's seen is in Liza's disregard for her own humiliation and her identification with his torment. That, it turns out, that capacity for selfless love in future novels of Dostoevsky will be the only alternative to egocentric and self-destructive efforts of the underground man. But they're not available to him, because he's a product of the wrong-headed influences from the West, and he misses the point altogether. By how far he misses it suggests how far lost he is in the worlds of Jeremy Bentham and Adam Smith and Chernyshevsky. So, this is a Swiftian satire, which demands from us a kind of alert and agile reading. It's full of complicated questions, and its solutions are solutions which we have to look at very carefully, because we're always having to remember to sort of invert them, to read them inside out and backwards. The novel is important, I think, to us in this course in three different ways. For one, it does suggest the direction that Dostoevsky's fiction will take in the next two decades. It's a setup. It seems difficult to imagine how he could have written those last four great novels if he hadn't written this one first. Secondly, it's important in that in the underground man's awareness that there must be an alternative to his own self-destructive course to assure himself of his freedom and humanity, and in Liza's awareness that we have to be bound together in love, we have the first portrait of Sonia that we're going to get in Crime and Punishment, and we're also going to begin to get some of the really complex visions of history that we will run across in the Grand Inquisitor's review of human nature and history in The Brothers Karamazov. The ultimate solution for Dostoevsky to these laws of nature will lie not in individualistic assertion, not sticking our tongue out at the Crystal Palace, but in a kind of corporate and altruistic dedication of ourselves to others. All of that is implicit in this work, and all of that will be developed and made explicit in the novels that follow. The other way in which this novel is important to us is perhaps for us a little bit more harrowing. We live in a world that is so much closer to the ideals of the Crystal Palace than Chernyshevsky's Utopia, and Chernyshevsky's Utopia than Dostoevsky did. Those of us who are in the middle class buy our cars, which are stamped out at the same factories. We buy our clothes on suggestions from the same ads in the same magazines and newspapers and television. We watch the same movies and TV programs. We eat the same food purchased from the same chain grocery stores. We do the same thing for recreation, and we stay in the same hotels in the same cities. Our assumption is that having these things, we are exercising rational self-interest and hence pursuing personal happiness, which will keep us, as Candide says, which will keep us from vice and poverty and boredom. Over and over again, we illustrate every day those laws of nature against which the underground man sets his whole being. And we need to wonder, critics have raised these questions and asked, We are always, us middle-class people are always totally stunned by the amazing increase in gang violence and vandalism in cities, for example, which looks to us like irrational, self-destructive behavior. But, the underground man would say, might not that be evidence of the will for freedom and humanity itself? Might it not be Cleopatra sticking pins in the breast of her slaves because the pain shows that we're alive and not just piano keys? Other critics have suggested that in our day, the subway might be the perfect modern version of the underground man. Thousands of pale people falling into chutes every day on their way to identical jobs in Chernyshevsky's utopia. Dostoevsky is asking in this novel, isn't there something inside each one of us? A little tiny impulse to blow something up, to throw a rock through the window of the Crystal Palace, to stick pins in a fellow subway traveler just to prove that we're still alive. And that's a really provocative question. In terms of storytelling, Dostoevsky has taught us yet one more way to tell a story. That is inside out and backwards, using a persona whom we have to take ironically in order to understand what's really going on. It's an amazing performance. If we don't like the underground man, I don't think that Dostoevsky would be shocked. In fact, I think we'd be more shocked if we did wind up liking him or admiring him. But we do need to pay attention to what he says. In our next lecture, we will be taking a look at a third brand of realism, realism American style, as we visit America for the very first time in this course, to take up what Ernest Hemingway said was the true beginning of all modern American fiction, Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, and we'll get a chance to see how some of the things we've learned about narrative technique in this course will help us understand Huck's story and his story as he tells us about how he tried to run away from too much civilization. That's our next lecture.